1977 or online our website alternativeradio.org.
Arab governments have largely remained passive spectators as Gaza has been reduced to rubble despite their immense wealth and influence. While some have made symbolic gestures or pledged aid, many continue to normalize ties with Israel or avoid direct confrontation. What role should the Arab governments play in, let's say, rebuilding Gaza or relieving the population of Gaza from this destruction and sorrow?
I'm not going to talk to the should, because there the answer is obvious. I want to talk about what the historical record shows. There was a period when the Palestine cause had immense, not material power, obviously, didn't have an army or economic wealth, but it had something else, and it's an interesting fact. It had quite significant symbolic power, which is to say, Arab governments genuinely feared the Palestinian cause. So if you take one example, which I'm familiar with because I've studied the historical record, Jimmy Carter recently passed. Well, he was an extremely smart guy. And in his own way, he was an honorable guy. He was an awful president. He was the one that negotiated the Israel-Egypt agreement beginning in 1977 and climaxing in 1979. And it was very impressive to read the historical record. He just knew exactly what to do. He was very systematic, very methodical, and he had a terrifying grasp of detail. I mean, it would take your breath away to read, because we have the original documents and how he makes these marginal comments. You know, when his advisors present to him some agreement to read or pertaining to Israel-Palestine, and you read his marginal comments and the level of micro detail that he had mastered was totally breathtaking. In any event, when he comes into office, he's determined he's going to solve the whole Israel-Palestine conflict. He then realizes that the Israelis are too dug in their heels. You can't do it. The only thing the Israelis were willing to do was to sign an agreement with Egypt. And the reason was very simple. It'll be a big surprise among young people, but Egypt was the powerhouse of the Arab world up until this Camp David agreement that was negotiated by President Carter or through President Carter. And the foreign minister at the time, who was also prominent in the military establishment, was a fellow named Moshe Dayan. And Dayan famously said, if you remove one wheel from a car, the car is stuck. It can't move. And so he said, if we remove the Egyptian wheel from the Arab front, they can't make war anymore, because Egypt was the powerhouse. So Israel didn't want another war like 1973, which was a pretty big catastrophe for them in many ways. The estimates are between 2,000 and 3,000 Israeli combatants were killed. And for a while, it looked like Israel was going to disappear. Turned out to be inflated, that fear, but it was actually believed. So they wanted to make the Arab world impotent, and the way they thought to do it was to remove the Egyptian wheel from the car. So Israel was willing to sign an agreement with Egypt, but no more. whereas the Arab world wanted to just solve the problem. That is, a two-state settlement according to international law. The Palestinians have the right to self-determination and statehood in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza and so forth. So why do I bring all this up? I bring it up because Jimmy Carter, being very systematic and methodical, he tours the whole Arab world. He goes to the Saudis, of course. And he says, if there's an agreement between Egypt and Israel, you will you support it? The Saudis say, nope, we can't do anything unless you give the Palestinians a state. Now remember, Palestine, they have no material power. They have no military power, but they have this tremendous symbolic power in the Arab world. The Arab head of state says, we cannot agree to a deal that doesn't give the Palestinians a state. And Sadat, as you can imagine, he's panicking because if he can't get any support from the Arab world for this agreement, then it's going to make him look like a traitor. And you know what happens to traitors? They get shot. And so in many ways, Jimmy Carter was responsible for Sadat's assassination because he insisted on the deal in the absence of any Arab support. Now, I want to be clear. Sadat wanted a deal too, for sure, because the country was going through food riots. It was very unstable, and he just wanted the American money. He wanted to join the American alliance. He basically, if you read the record, he said to Carter, you do whatever you want, and I'll agree with you. Whatever you want, you just do it, and I'll sign. And so he was, Jimmy Carter was Egypt's negotiator. So that's no longer true. Palestine doesn't have symbolic value the way it once did in the Arab world. And the question is why? I think the obvious answer is because since that era, there have been so many catastrophes in the Arab world. There's been Iraq. There's been Libya. There's been Syria. And on, that the horror of the situation among the Palestinians began to pale in the face of now the inward-looking countries of the Arab world faced with all of their own domestic calamities and catastrophes. I'm not making an apology. I'm simply stating the facts. There were about 2 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. That's the total population of Gaza, these numbers. And these are the catastrophes that have befallen the Arab world. Having said that, the fact remains, apart from the Houthis in Yemen and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Arab world abandoned the people of Gaza. If you look at the various operations I mentioned, there was very little support in the West Bank for the people of Gaza. Very little. During the Great March of Return in March 2018, there was no support, none in the West Bank for the nonviolent civil resistance in Gaza. The fact of the matter is, if you put aside the Houthis in Yemen and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the biggest support for Gaza, and it's tremendously moving in its own way, You know where it came from? South Africa. South Africa was so tenacious, persistent. Most of you know some of the record, but you don't know all of the record. They submitted on December 29th, 2023, what they called an application to the ICJ, International Court of Justice, charging that Israel was in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. Their application was 84 pages. It was single-spaced. It had over 500 footnotes. And for each footnote, there were like three references. It was a huge amount of work. Israel ignored what the ICJ ruled in January. They go before the court again in February. They submit a new compilation of documentation. The court says Israel has to do what it was ordered to do in January. It repeats that. Israel ignores. South Africa goes before them again in March. Another thick compilation of facts, statistics, references, and so forth. And then guess what? It goes before them again in May. It keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And then if you go to what's called Letter to the Secretary Security Council, Letter to the Security Council, May 29th, 2024, they give up on the ICJ because Israel is ignoring it, and they now go to the Security Council, and they say, Israel is ignoring what the ICJ said, you have to act. And they submit a compilation. It's 121 pages, and it is so meticulously documented. I mean, it's just a breathtaking amount of work and investment. And now the case itself is before the court, and hold your breath, they submitted a 750-page, what's called memorial, with 4,000 pages of supplementary documentation. Now you ask yourself, what did the rest of the Arab world do? I think the silence answers the question, as in nothing. I don't blame the people. I'm sure their hearts go out. Why did the Houthis, why are they so adamant? You know why? Because what was done to Gaza was done to them. The Saudi blockade. The Saudi blockade, which I think killed in 2 years. I don't remember the exact number, but something like 80,000 people died from starvation because of those Saudi monsters. So they know what was done, what's being done to Gaza, was done to them. And the Hezbollah, you know, people want to say it's manipulated by Iran. And yeah, there was, you know, you can't deny the fact that Iran is a factor. But my own estimate, I'm not going to argue with people because I know people from Syria have very sincere, legitimate grievances against the Hezbollah. And I'm not going to quarrel with that. But I think on the whole, Sayyid Nasrallah was an extremely intelligent, honorable, and dignified figure. And I think his death left a huge void in the Arab world. He was a new voice. He was a new voice in the Arab world. He cared. Some of you know Edward Said. And when Hassan Nasrallah was a young man, Edward Said met him. And he wrote just briefly about him because he wasn't well known at the time when Professor Said wrote about him. And he said, there's two things about Nasrallah which differ from any other Arab leader, he said, I've ever met. Number one, he was always on time. No, it's a sign. It's a sign of seriousness. You know, the other Arab leaders, they come in 5 hours late, like they're so important and everybody else's time is unimportant. So they'll come in 5 hours late, 7 hours late. And he was always on time. And number two, all the other Arab leaders he met, meaning Professor Said, they were always surrounded by armed militia with their, you know, with their machine guns. He said, when he met Hassan Nasrallah, no, none of that, none of those theatrics. He was serious. He read. I remember Professor Chomsky met him. They met for a serious amount of time. And you asked Professor Chomsky, so what was he like? And Professor Chomsky will say, you don't really know, because all he did was ask questions. He just wanted to suck in information. He wasn't there to show off, to show how much, you know, how important he is. He wanted to learn.
I know a lot of people were shocked with the recent statement by President Trump that he's going to turn Gaza into basically a Riviera and take over. I actually found it to be amusing. And I thought that there's some truth to this, in the sense that it was put out because Trump is not a politician and he says what's basically happening. And I think what was made very clear is that this is a case of ethnic cleansing, and the fact that Netanyahu stood there smirking next to him, I think for the entire world now to say, you know, including the students that have been harassed by the university for asking for divestment, etc., then now it's for the entire world to see that this is a case of ethnic cleansing, and it's intentional. I think also it's going to make it a little bit more difficult for Arab governments, as tyrannical and non-representative as they are, to stand with someone like Trump and to say, yeah, you know, we want to work with you, when he clearly said, I'm going to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Well, I happen to agree with all of those statements. I think you would have to be more blind than King Lear not to see what was going on the last 15 months. It was an ethnic cleansing which didn't succeed at the beginning because Egypt said no go into the Sinai. And then it became an ethnic cleansing by default, namely, there's nothing left. And so the people have to go. And I have to acknowledge, it is a tough question now. What do you do? There is nothing there. And I don't have, you know, people want to conjure these heroic images of Palestinians. And yes, they've been extremely tenacious and they've been heroic. But at the end of the day, they're human beings. They're not supermen and they're not superwomen. So if you read the stories, yes, they did march en masse to the north after the ceasefire began. But if you read the footnotes, when they went to the north and they discovered nothing was there and there was no water, a lot of them turned around and went back to the south to their tents. It doesn't make them less heroic. If you read the statements of the Israelis, the ones that are not reported here, but are in abundance when you read them, collected, that was the whole goal, to make Gaza unlivable, so that the people of Gaza would have two choices, stay and starve or leave. That was the goal. Now, you could deduce the goal on the basis of what they were saying, or you could deduce it or infer it from their actions. If you destroy 92% of the housing, What choice do the people of Gaza have? I don't think there's...
If you want to take them from Gaza, as I said, let them go to where they belong. You know all the people of Gaza from where? They are from Jaffa, from Haifa, from Lid, from Ramla. The Israeli kicked them out. They should go back to their homeland. That's where they should go.
Is there any hope to de-radicalize the youth within Israel? Or is their Zionist beliefs too deep-rooted? And if so, how should that process be made?
But you call the youth are the ones who are in the front line carrying out the genocide inside Gaza. They're the most over the top. So anyone looking for hope there, I think it's an utter waste of time. In some situations, there's no rational grounds for hope for a population. If you take the United States during the Civil Rights Movement, the whites in the South were very dug in. You can count on the fingers of one hand the number of whites in any town who supported an end to the Jim Crow segregation system. The only way to break it was when the federal government, for various reasons, decided it was time to end that system. And they brought to bear, for various reasons, the full weight of our national government, including its armed force, to break the will of the South, to look for, quote unquote, progressive whites in the American South, was a complete waste of time. It didn't exist. And I don't believe there is any, quote unquote, there's no significant anti-genocide sentiment inside Israel. As Lee Mordechai pointed out in his compilation, Israel's most revered newspaper for its liberal sentiments is Haaretz. And there was very little dissent, he said, in Haaretz, which liberals here love to quote. It was very little dissent. He said in his compilation, Haaretz went along with the genocide. That's the liberal, ultra-liberal sectors of Israeli society. It's a uniform response across the board there. And as I said, it's pretty hard to fathom when you read it. There was that great African-American athlete, singer, he was everything, Paul Robeson. And I was very angry when I came into the Milwaukee airport and they had a poster of great African-Americans. They didn't have Paul Robeson and they didn't have W.E.B. Du Bois on it. And I said, I'm not coming back to this airport. In any case, he used to sing the song, The House I Live In. What is America to me? And then he has the famous line, the right to speak my mind out. That's America to me. The right to speak my mind out. If it makes you uncomfortable, walk away. If it makes you feel unwanted, go among a crowd where you feel wanted. And if it makes you feel unsafe, fine, you can call the police. But the police can't arrest you for speaking your mind out. We should seize back those rights, those values, and hopefully turn the tide.
You were just listening to Norman Finkelstein on Israel's goal in Gaza. Norman Finkelstein, son of Holocaust survivors, is a distinguished independent scholar who has long focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Rami Khoury, Ilan Pape, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Francesca Albanese, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Norman Finkelstein on Israel's goal in Gaza, and for the Rashid Khalidi classic book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Paul Robeson singing The House I Live In.
What is America to me? A name, a map of a flag I see. A certain word, a democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me. Thank you.